On our earth, before writing was invented, before the printing press was invented, poetry flourished. That's why we know that poetry is like bread. It should be shared by all, by scholars and by peasants, by all our vast, incredible, extraordinary family of humanity. That was Pablo Neruda. I'm Bob Holman, and this is the Poetry is Bread podcast, where poetry challenges us, makes us think, and with imagination and courage and heart, changes the world. Trublante, the temple, nostalgia of the infinite. Come on, these are the titles of books by Janet Hamill, who had 11 at last count. Lost Ceilings. All right, that's the name of her band. The band took its name from her book of poems. These words evoke a world apart, mysterious and dark and other. Janet Hamill is a trance poet, and by that I mean that when she reads, she enters a trance-like state. Her voice careens up and otherworldly. She's in conversation with Rimbaud, Baudelaire, Jack Kerouac. Her poems then levitate you. Look at you all covered in webs and kisses. She writes poems and stories. She's at work on a novel. She's a painter also, whose main subject is the cosmos. Not a bad place to start. And she's a Jersey girl who attended Glassboro State College, now Rowan University, with her dear friend and oftentimes collaborator, Patti Smith. In fact, it was Janet who suggested that Patti might want to read some of this Rimbaud character. And the two of them, completely in love with poetry, have been best friends ever since. Patti's played on her albums. Janet's got two albums, both with the Upstate Garage Band, previously named Lost Ceilings. Janet and Patti have collaborated on books, and Janet's poems make a perfect opening act for the Patti Smith Band. Janet and I go way back. She was a Poets Theater regular back when Poets Theater was a mainstay at the St. Mark's Poetry Project with the final productions down at La Mama. Productions that included Taylor Mead as an actor, Susan Laurie Parks as a writer, et cetera, et cetera. I could go on, but let's stay, please, with Janet, whose formalism is indomitable. She'll bring you a sestina that'll set you back, and yet her content is almost antithetical. It's as if the constellations of the stars are being laid out in front of you. A map is hidden inside of every poem. A map that when you reach the end, you're back at the beginning. The treasure being something that you'll never lose. Let's listen to Janet Hamill. So I was sitting in the land of poetry. Let's talk with Janet Hamill. Bob Holman here, high atop Bowery Poetry Club and across the street from
our former old hangout, CBGB's.
CBGB's. Yeah. You know, I always put the possessive onto it, but when you look it up on Wikipedia,
they don't put the S?
They don't put the S. It's just CBGB.
Huh.
Country.
Country blues.
Bluegrass. And other music.
Yeah.
Underground gourmands.
Oh, yes.
CBGB.
Yes.
Omfug.
Yes, Umphug.
Full title from Hilly.
That's right, I forgot the Umphug.
You know, I actually that read in that place. It was on the
awning.
Awning that now says John Varvatos.
I know.
Where for $700 you can buy the previously priceless ripped blue jeans that you would never sell.
I know.
Pre-ripped now.
I wouldn't even wear them. When they got ripped, it was time for a new pair.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because when they got ripped, that's when it was time for me to wear them.
Ah.
You know.
No, I always had to have new ones. Yes. That was always a big thing because you would wear them for a few years. So when you bought a new pair, it was a big deal. I could get a new pair of jeans.
Do you remember the first time that Patty played at CBGB, or the first time you went
there? I don't know if I was there the very first time. I was probably there one of the very first times. I remember when she did start playing there.
Yeah.
And it was before the album and before Horses, and they were just trying out new material. And it was before CBGB's had really even caught on. But I used to go, as I used to go to all her shows, you know, and all the little different venues she played in whenever we were both in town at the same time. And she always put me on the guest list, so, you know.
Yay.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just there to support her. Yeah. Yeah. And then I was actually in the recording studio when they did Horses.
What was that like?
It was great. I wasn't working at the time. So they would start about, they did an Electric Ladyland on 8th Street, and they would begin at night. So I wasn't working, and I was keeping the same crazy hours. I would show up about 9 o'clock, and they'd either be in the middle of recording something, or they had just stopped something, you know, and John Cale was the producer, and I remember loving his sense of humor. And he and I hit it off really well. But he and Patty sparred all the time. And Robert used to come too. You know, we were both there to support her. And I remember my best memory really is the one night Robert and I were there together. And he had liquid hash, which I had never had before. And Robert was so mischievous. He had such a mischievous streak. He loved to tease me. Always gently, teasing with love, you know? But he gave me the liquid hash. And then we took, it's quite cavernous once you get in there, Electric Ladyland. So we were wandering around these psychedelically painted hallways. And he waited until I was really high on liquid hash to tell me that one of our best friends from the old Pratt days had committed suicide.
Oh my goodness.
That was Robert. That was Robert.
That, what a sense of humor.
Yeah. Yeah, that was Robert. But, you know, I loved him so much, and it was really out of friendship, and it was just mischievous.
Yeah.
You know, that's him, me, you know, he would do that kind of thing, you know, but, yeah.
Well, so.
Yeah, but it was really great. It was really wonderful.
Yeah. What would Cale and Patty be sparring about?
You name it, and any little detail. I mean, for one, he wanted the. I thought the musicians were great, you know, because I was stoned all the time anyway, so you know they sounded great to me. But you know, he was a trained musician from Juilliard. He could tell everything was out of tune, so we wanted them to all go out and get new instruments. So that got everybody all upset, you know. And then she had certain ideas. She wanted me to sing on the album and as a background vocal. And he said, no, he didn't want that. And just all nitpicking, really. All nitpicking. Yeah.
Well, let's rewind. You know, let's go back. How did you get involved in poetry? When, you know, what was it? Where were the poems that found you?
Well, it really goes back to high school, and I can remember the exact moment.
Where were you?
I was in my living room in suburban northern New Jersey, and my junior year of high school.
What high school were you going to?
New Milford High in New Milford, New Jersey. And my English teacher was just so glamorous, and I just adored her. I emulated her. I just wanted to be her. She really did look quite a bit like Greta Garbo.
Oh.
She had this kind of long, sweeping hair, you know, this long wave that she was constantly brushing back over her hair.
Do you remember her name, Janice?
Yes, Gloria Okulski. And she had been a floor model on Fifth Avenue in the department stores on, you know, Saks and Lord & Taylor before she married and settled down and decided to teach English. But she was just so striking and so glamorous and a great teacher. And
Mrs. Okulski. That sounds a little Polish, maybe.
She was, yeah. And she was blonde. And I mean, I adored her so much. She was the head of the opera club. So I joined the opera club, even though I could have cared less about opera, just to be in her club.
What kind of music did you like?
I liked rock and roll, and I was just then starting to get into folk music, and I actually did love Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett at the time, and classical music, but I hadn't crossed over into opera, and opera's never really quite put on with me, other than something like Luciano Pavarotti. I adored that, him and the three tenors, all that. Anyway, junior year, we had the British poetry, and the weekend assignment was to read Thomas Gray's Elegy Written in a Country Churchyard, which is early Romantic, pre-Romantic. And I remember sitting there on a Sunday afternoon, I believe it was early spring, maybe March, kind of a gray day, and I was just transfixed. You know, as if the world just faded away, it was just me and that poem. The world came
in
to
your
stop.
Living room.
In my living room.
In New Milford.
In New Milford, yeah, yeah. And at that point, I knew some poetry was going to somehow be a big part of my life.
Were there any books in the living room?
No. I grew up in cultural depravity.
Yeah. No, and there's a record player.
Record player was downstairs, and my father had redone the half of the cellar.
Right.
So we had. That's
what was that? The den? They call. What do they call that?
Then? Yeah,
the
I guess so. Well, it was like a three-story little Cape Cod in a development, and he refinished the attic because the attic wasn't finished when we moved in, and then he refinished the basement, and all the neighbors did the same thing. Half of the basement would be. Yeah, like the family room, they all built bars, and we have this wallpaper with musical notes on it,
uh-huh.
And that's where the record player was. I mean, music was very big in the family, but not books. I mean, they were like a handful of little books that my father had held on to for some reason, and they were kept upstairs in my brother Bill's room, and to me, they were like these mysterious little objects, you know? I mean, I didn't really quite understand what they were, why we even had them. The only books we really had were Golden Books. And the only other literature that came into the house was Time magazine. And I remember it when it came, you know, it was like this, you know, who was gonna get it first? Who was gonna get their hands on it first, you know?
And you're one of five kids.
One of five. And when I got into high school, and my dad was very artistic and very, very smart. He could play instruments, he could write well, he could sing, he sang in the choir at the Catholic Church, and he could draw. He could draw very well. So whatever talents I have, that's where it comes from. But so when I got into
You're painting still, huh?
Yeah, I do still paint, yeah. We used to always get the Sunday Daily News for the comics, and I remember insisting one year in high school, I said, Daddy, please can we get the Times on Sunday? So I introduced the family to the New York Times. But I was the only one who read it. No one had it, because it had no comics in it. Yeah. So that's the kind of atmosphere, you know, It's pop culture. Total pop culture. And to this day, I mean, you know, it's the same. I have one nephew who's kind of taking it after me, but it's still a family that just loves pop culture. Yeah.
So Miss Olkowski.
Yeah.
Was, had you read?
Elegy Written in a Country Churchyard. And that was just a start. You know, from there it was Blake and Coleridge and Wordsworth and Byron, Keats, and Shelley, and I was just spinning. That's, you know.
Did you start to write at that point?
No, I didn't start to write until college.
So, but you were reading a lot of poetry.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you went off to college.
I went to college actually to be, you know, become like Mrs. Olkowski, become a high school English teacher. But somebody knew I was so in love, enamored of poetry and involved in it in my own private way, and they pushed me onto the literary magazine. And
what college was this?
Glassboro State College in South Jersey. And the family had no money. I was the first in the entire history of the family to go to college. My parents didn't want me to go. That was a big deal. I had a guidance counselor who stepped in and told my parents, you know, your daughter really should, you know, go to college. You know. They just wanted me to be a secretary in, you know, in the city for a little while, meet a nice man in the office, and settle down and have kids, just like my mother had done, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but I knew that wasn't for me. And, anyway.
Anything on your mother's side? Does your mother have any leanings
all
towards the
really
arts?
Colorful. Her side of the family was extremely colorful. My grandmother was in vaudeville. And, you know, this is in...
Your mother's mother.
My mother's mother. This is, you know, during World War I and just afterwards. And I think I still have a picture of her, one of her tutus and everything.
Oh.
She had stockings on, and she always made a point to let you know that she had stockings on, that those are not her bare legs in that picture, you know. But she did, she traveled up and down, you know, mainly from New York to Boston, New York, upstate New York. The family was based in Hoboken and Weehawken in Hudson County, New Jersey. And yeah, she was on the stage, yeah.
So did you know your grandmother?
Yes, yeah. She used to sing. Whenever the family would get together, and then they all have a couple of beers, you know, whether it was in the backyard or down in the bar basement, and they'd sing these old songs from the 20s and the 30s. Like, I can't even remember some of them, but she had a voice like Ethel Merman.
Ha ha!
She belted it out, you know. Yeah, she was a character. But my mom, you know, she was just a great person, totally down to earth, but she didn't have any, she had no desire for showbiz or anything like that, you know. She wasn't going to take after her mother. And she was an only child. She really did just want to have a whole lot of kids. Yeah, yeah. So
there you are. What was the name of the college again?
Glassboro State. It was a state school in New Jersey, right. And way down in South Jersey.
Did you commute from home, or did you?
No. I lived in the dorms. Most of the students were commuting students, and but joining the literary magazine was really fantastic. It really changed my life. That's when I started actually writing. That's when I met some wonderful people, one of them being Patty. But also some other people, Bill Hart, Paul McCoskey, Bob Schaeff, all really talented writers. I mean, I thought they were really all going to be great writers, all great poets. And I didn't think it was going to be me.
Mm-hmm.
And those early literary magazines, and I still have copies of them, I wrote the poems and Patty did the illustrations. She was an art major.
Wow.
So she wasn't writing back then. But yeah.
So how did you first meet?
in the office of the literary magazine. And she came up to me. I'd seen her on campus, and she came up to me and talked to me about something. And I was very shy, and I didn't take to people very easily. I just, you know, I was kind of, didn't take to her right away. And then we were part of the Beatnik Coterie on campus. So we were also involved in the theater, the campus productions of theater. And I was madly in love with theater too. I even wanted to be an actress, entertain that thought.
So were you in some plays?
Yeah.
What plays were you in?
Oh, what is this play? It's a two-woman play. I forget the name of it. And I was in, I played one of the characters from Commedia dell'arte, Piero and Pirouette. I was in one. I forget the names of the plays. And I think the two-woman play may have been by Ibsen.
Hmm. Don't know that.
But I didn't, I may not be right about the author. But in any event, the one woman did all the talking and I did all the reacting. I didn't speak at all. So I just had to react. But in the other play, the one where the characters were from Commedia dell'arte. But something makes me think that was at Edna St. Vincent Millay, if she wrote any theater.
Well, I think she did.
It was a short play, I believe so. Pardon me if I can't remember. But Bill Hart directed that one, and he was one of the real talented poets on the literary magazine. And it was one of those things where I really went into a trance and I blacked out. I have no memory of that performance whatsoever. It was amazing.
Well, trance is a word that I've used with your work.
I know.
It's when I first heard you, your poems were so different from everybody else's in the scene downtown Manhattan in the 70s, 80s. Because number one, you memorized your poems.
Yeah.
Number two, when you read them, you seemed to go into a trance yourself, which then induced a trance-like state in your listeners, brought us along with you. Was that when you were writing these poems in college? Were they the same kind of poems?
No, they weren't nearly as good. I was writing very short line poems.
Who were your models then?
Dylan Thomas was one of my first great loves.
Mm.
And my private library takes up almost a shelf.
Mm.
Yeats, T.S. Eliot, they were my big faves.
Mm.
They were really the first big faves, other than the ones I mentioned in high school, the Romantics.
When did Baudelaire and Rimbaud and those guys come in?
They came in the city.
Oh, it wasn't, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I'd always thought that those were the poets that you got together with Patty over.
No, well, yes, indeed. And going back to Patty, we really did bond one day backstage at the Glassboro Theater. And that was another hangout place, you know, for the people who were involved in the Beatnik Coterie, people on the literary magazine. And
did Patty work on the theater?
Yeah, she worked in theater
what
too.
Did
she acted. She acted.
Right.
She was in a production of Phaedra. She played Phaedra. And she was in The Boyfriend, doing some kind of crazy tap dancing thing.
Oh my goodness.
Singing, tap dancing, yeah. But anyway, it was dark and it was just the two of us and it was just floppy old used sofas back there, you know, and she just confided in me this very, very personal thing that she was going through at the time. And
it was a relationship or family?
Yes, it was a relationship thing.
Mm-hmm.
And no one had ever confided something like that in me, you know, and I was like, I'm just a real listener. And that was it. That kind of solidified us. yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, after college then?
After college, Patty came first. I stayed on to graduate. She came up first to go to the city. And she had friends in from South Jersey who were at Pratt. Excuse me. So she gravitated to Pratt, because we didn't know anyone in the city at all other than these people at Pratt. And then when I graduated, it was just a couple months later, she said, come on, why don't you come move to the city? So by then she had, that summer, it was the summer of 67, she had met Robert and was already living with Robert. And I got my own place on Clinton Avenue. I don't know what the neighborhood is called, what Pratt is.
Well, it's pretty much called Pratt.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't, it probably has a room, all these neighborhood names.
Well, there's
names.
Clinton Hill, you know.
Is it? Because we didn't call it anything then.
Yeah.
And I had an apartment, like a studio apartment, just a few blocks away. And I saw them just about every single day. And then Patty, you know, I was working with Scribner's. Patty got a job at Scribner's. And
what were you doing there?
A book clerk. I was in heaven. I was in New York working in. I used to go there from Jersey. Used to go to Scribner's just to be there, you know? The publishing house was on top.
Right.
And it still was back then. And, you know, that
so
Maxwell
where was the bookstore?
Perkins.
Where was Scribner's?
Scribner's was at 48th and 5th.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer there. But it was beautiful. It had a mezzanine. It's just beautifully designed. And I worked upstairs in the poetry section. You know, poetry, philosophy. And it looked out over Fifth Avenue. It was perfect.
Mm.
It was great. And, you know, back then, the ideal was if you could make in a week what your rent was, you were fine. You were doing just fine financially. And that was the case. I made $75 a week. My rent was $75 a month.
Those were the
days. The rest was spent on books.
Right. And those were the days when Frank O'Hara was just down the street from you, leaving the Museum of Modern Art to type up his poems on the Olivetti typewriters.
Yeah.
Set up as displays in front of the
Olivetti
building.
Yeah, all that was
all that. Lots of poetry.
All
in
that
air.
Mythology. I remember one time Patty and I walked from Second Avenue from the United Nations all the way down to, you know, where St. Mark's is, down to the Lower Side to 8th Street, in honor of Frank O'Hara, in honor of his poem, Second Avenue.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's funny when you started to talk about that bookstore. Your voice moved into that range that I remember from those poems that were so special. You know, it's funny, when I was, you know, back at the New Eureka, and I felt called upon to divide the poetry world up into my own taxonomy, and you and Wanda Coleman were the trance poets, because both of you had the poem so instilled in the physicality of your bodies that when it came out, it just felt like you were there, we were moved into this trance place. Of course, your aesthetic's totally different, but that place you got the audience to was unlike anything else. Still, do you have one of those poems that you could?
Yeah, I do.
Give.
I do. Yes. This is called L'Amour Extraordinaire, and Poe, being one of my favorite American poets, this is about his death. And mind you, I wrote this before I discovered Mallarmé, and knew that Mallarmé had written La Tombe, the Edgar Allan Poe.
The Tomb of Poe, yeah.
Yeah. Poe exploded into 1,000 pieces, the abominable atrocities of his mind, scattered and swallowed by vengeful birds, the angel hooked, the falcon hooded, his bones, rocking the quiet of small coast towns in a whirlpool, the rocks of ages split, to dig down and reverse the velocity, the chemical spin in a centrifuge, call, stop, and the lid is hurled into space. Bone china, luminescence, smooth white skin of an innocent, embalmed and rested peace, the crows fly out of his skull. Ooh. I'm a little older now. Hopefully it still has the same intensity.
Yes, it does. That's an amazing poem, the way it pulls us there. You hear the influences. You hear Yeats in there.
By then, I guess I was starting to fall in love with the symbolists.
Yeah.
But that all happened in New York. I remember first discovering Apollinaire, and and it goes back a little to Glassboro. One day, this professor from Temple, Glassboro was the nearest big city was Philadelphia, and the faculty advisor to the literary magazine had gotten this professor from Temple to come over and speak to us, the literary magazine crowd, and he spoke about French literature, the symbolists. And that was my first introduction. And I still have, it's Angel Flores, a little pink, what was the first edition, paperback, pink, with somebody standing in a green suit over a rail. That's where this whole green suit obsession with me came from, But when I came to the city, I bought Al Cools for the first time. And then from there, it progressed into Baudelaire, Mallarmé, Rimbaud. Actually, Baudelaire, Rimbaud. Mallarmé was a later great love of mine. Yeah.
So.
And Hart Crane. Hart Crane was in the city.
Wow. So then that was really the same. Didn't you write a poem about Hart Crane?
Yes.
Was that Sacrifice or was that a different?
No, that's not Sacrifice. No, it's called The Lonesome Death of H. Crane.
Oh, yeah.
And I got the title from Dylan, from Bob Dylan, The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. So, and since his name is Hart, and he's such a Hart, I thought, I like the irony of just saying H. Crane.
So,
but when I discovered him, I just went, I couldn't believe him. I just couldn't believe him. And I know we're not supposed to believe in the Pantheon anymore, but it just touches me that Harold Bloom, who does believe in the Pantheon, considers him the greatest American, it's his favorite American poet. He considers him the greatest American poet. And his output was not much, but to me, he was an American symbolist. They were at that point, and he knew William Carlos Williams. This is in the 20s in New York. There weren't that many people involved in poetry. Everyone kind of knew each other, but William Carlos Williams took American poetry in one direction. Hart Crane, and most people followed him. The Beats followed Carlos Williams, and not many people followed Hart Crane. Maybe because he was too obtuse. I don't know, but. He's the one, his language is just, every word is like a cut gem,
Yeah, you hear it in your performance there, I know this is a little bit, asking a lot, but do you have Sacrifice? Could you do Sacrifice for us?
I have Sacrifice. That one I have.
Yes, that one I would. Which I remember that being sort of the centerpiece of many a reading that you gave in those days.
This is totally written under the influence of Baudelaire. When I was really, really at the height of my Baudelaire obsession. And it has nothing to do with him. But it's, to me, somehow I like to think I somehow captured his essence. And if Baudelaire had been alive at the time this was written in the mid-70s, I used to think, I used to hope, well, if Baudelaire were alive now, I hope he would write like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly does seem to channel that, you know, that passion.
Yeah, so this is sacrifice. There's a fire inside the mountain where a puma rests. On the continents of silence, the unfurnished living rooms in space, where now a sacrifice takes place. Behind a land mass of skeletons, the ice floes creep, long lines of leopards in the snow. It's time to go, to keep the logs keep burning in a hailstorm. The ghost of a bat in the night stills, the windowsills are dirty, and hope trembles on the legs of a dying, praying mantis. Solstice, leave me now like this with the sun bleeding, holding Spanish hearts in my hands, the soft white neck of a Spanish throat, the face thrown back in resignation, the eyes pleading, close me now like this forever, shut the light, release the seas, the endless ocean voyages of melancholy. Ions flare in the fire. The bookshelves rise like a tower of the arcane world. You cling in a silk cocoon of a yellow sheet, like a wing of Baal's angels. The ancients press on your skull like a tumor. The manuscripts curl in a flame. And I light a light in the darkness. The cigarettes drop to the floor, and they reappear, the long lines of leopards in the snow. You have to go into a courtyard, into an unfurnished living room space to make your grace beneath the jaws of a generous lion, teeth kept down to the bone, a layer of platinum, morphine, erotic waves of criminal water. With a bite to the jugular, you break on through, releasing the final vials of congenital poison, pints of blood, and millenniums of endless ocean voyages.
Wow. I don't know that there's any... I guess you could say that Philip LaMantia, maybe, and that, you know, surrealism of that, you know, might go, but nobody touches that poem, Janet. That's really so. What was the, you know, when? What was the situation that brought that poem?
Oh, you love it, because you knew him. Remember, there's an old boyfriend, Roberto, my Argentine love.
Yes,
and we were forever breaking up and getting back together and breaking up and getting back together. And at one point, I just wanted him out of my life. So sacrifice it's like a poem. I'm sacrificing him. He's the person whose eyes are pleading, close me now like this forever, shut the light, release the seas, the endless ocean voyages of melancholy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what brought it on. But it was... American Prayer had come out with Jim Morrison reading, and that's Break On Through as the Doors, the Voyages and all that is probably Baudelaire and Hart Crane combined. And, don't know where it came from, all of it.
But how old were you when you wrote that one?
Ah, man. Probably about 30.
Yeah. And you were living in Manhattan at that
yeah,
point?
Yeah, I was living on Van Dam Street.
Okay.
I had just moved into Van Dam Street, right. And I remember, I found out later from another boyfriend, and I lived on the ground floor facing the street. And he used to, I didn't know this, he would walk by and look in the window and watch me writing that poem.
Oh, boy.
And I had an old electric, you know, and I was just banging out, and next morning read it and, you know, make the corrections, and then the next night, you know, go at it again.
So at this point, you know, Patty was already involved with St. Mark's, yeah?
Oh.
She's already involved with Sam Shepard.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's already, well, that's
already
like history.
Happened. Yeah. She did Cowboy Mouth, so her acting that she was doing at Glassboro continued.
Yeah.
Into that time there. So that's history. You never followed her into those worlds, those scenes.
No.
But you kept your friendship with her.
Yes, that's true. That's true. It is quite amazing that I never wanted to be more than a poet. And Patty even encouraged me. She said, "Why don't you work with a band?" This was when I was in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Oh, no, no, I don't." She said, you know enough musicians. Why don't you put a band together?" I said, "No, I didn't. I didn't at that time.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be the best poet I could possibly be. And I had already decided that I wasn't going to be an actress. You know, when I first came to the city, it's funny, Patty took a class. We both went to the New School. We both took courses together at the New School. Patty studied with Bill Berkson. And I took a class, I don't even remember the instructor's name, but it was on theater and acting and directing, because I still had dreams of perhaps being the next Geraldine Page. Yeah.
Right, and also then that's Federico Fellini, too.
Oh, yes, 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 whom I've written about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just think he's just one of the greatest geniuses ever. I wanted to be a filmmaker, but I just knew I just didn't quite have the personality for that. I could never be in that love of Federico. Yeah.
So, and Patty was studying with Berkson and writing their poems.
Were you
trying to get your poems published?
No, I didn't. I didn't get serious about it until, let's see. I went off and did my travels. I was writing, but I was very shy about it. I had such high regard for the poets that I admire. I couldn't see myself be considered the same kind of animal, you know. I just couldn't see it. I couldn't call myself a poet until I was well into my 30s. And that's because people started calling me a poet, and I figured, oh, well, I guess I am one. Everybody seems to think so. But I was that in awe of people like Hart Crane and Baudelaire.
So you started to travel.
Yes, that's right, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So that was my first great love. I wanted to see the world. Because I really believed all this, from my romance about being an artist, that you had to see the world. You had to have as much experience as possible, as far as relationships and seeing the world, so that your life was rich, so that what you had to write about was rich, so that you weren't writing from an ivory tower or in a bubble, you know. So, and one of my favorite films, probably still to this day, is Lawrence of Arabia. Even though, I mean, because it's just all desolation and Peter O'Toole and all his brilliant white robes and everything, and the desert. And I just love the aesthetic of Arab art, Moorish art. And so that was my first destination was Morocco and Africa. And I did eventually want to get down to the Serengeti Plains to see the animals in their natural habitat, which did happen all on that journey. It was quite a journey.
And how long was that journey? Who did you travel with? How
I
did
traveled
that come
with
about?
A boyfriend who's now quite known as a photographer, Neil Winokur. And he's married to quite well-known curator, you probably know, at the Modern, Ann Umlin.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So Neil and I made that journey together. We were gone about a year, but you could, you know, you could. We were young. You could just you know, sleep on the ground under the stars half the times, you know.
Yeah.
And we pretty much made it on what we had saved, and then we got stranded in Nairobi, and Neil at the time was working for The Strand. And Fred Bass was quite a generous man, and he wired Fred Bass, and Fred sent him money, and to get us out of Africa, and then Neil went back to when we got back. Neil went back to working at The Strand, and eventually paid him off.
So were you right?
Those things could happen then.
Yes.
And then when I came back, I got serious about writing. Then I decided, okay, settle down in New York and get serious about this. And Patty set up my first reading. It was at a loft in Chelsea. And I read with Annie Powell, and who was the woman who was Jackson Pollock's lover, and she was in the car crash with him that killed Jackson Pollock. I can't think of her name right now.
Well, Sam is going to Google that for you right now.
Okay. Because she was the three of us. Annie Powell went on to become Ruth Klickman. Thank you, Ruth Klickman. So it was my first reading, and I always felt from the beginning that the poems should be memorized so that you could deliver them like a song, so that you know. You would be interpreting it.
Where'd you get that idea?
It was original, I think. I don't think I'd ever seen it.
I guess the guys before books were
It must be from Dylan Thomas.
Well, he didn't memorize his stuff.
I don't think he did, but he was just such a brilliant reader.
Did you ever hear him read?
Not in person, no, but I was a big fan of recordings, you know, to this day.
Don't think your grandmother had anything to do
with
this.
No, I don't think Nanabert had anything to do with that. No. She was all vaudeville, you know.
Yeah.
She would like me to be in musicals on Broadway, if anything. So, I guess it had to do with that, you know. I think it was probably Dylan Thomas's influence.
Mm.
You know, I'd seen films of him, and I had recordings of him, and I just thought by memorizing it, it would be like memorizing a song, and then you could interpret it like Billie Holiday or something.
Right.
You're interpreting the words, you know. So that's where that all came from. And I remember to prepare for that first reading. I'm talking so much about Patty, but she does play a big part in my life, especially when I was young. Patty's sister, Linda, was living at the time on 10th Street. She had a tiny little studio apartment right down the street from St. Mark's. And I lived on St. Mark's Place. And I would go over every night for a week and work with her, you know, memorize the poems, read them out loud to her, memorize, you know, every night we worked. And then I read that night in the loft, and everything was memorized. And I remember Renee Ricard was there, because Patty was friends with Renee. And he came up to me afterwards, he said, "You're gonna be a star."
Well, Renee knew. You know, he was a great judge of talent, that dude. You know,
he was a sweetie.
So I'm assuming that maybe the Poe poem and Sacrifice were in that reading. I don't know. Would you?
Not Sacrifice, but Poe.
Yeah.
I know that was written, because that was written right after I came back from... I lived in San Francisco for a year, and, the end of the Haight-Ashbury thing, and then came back to New York once again and settled in New York to save money to go to Africa. And I was with Neil then. That's when I lived on St. Mark's Place, and that's when that poem was written.
So were there poems about Africa in the reading then that you did?
No. It took a while. I think the first poem about Africa was The Big Sleep, which is in the temple. Mm-hmm. Most of the temple is about Africa, and. Things have to seep into me. I can't write really when it's a fresh experience. It just it has to distill, I guess, like wine.
That's what makes Nock so incredible is the way that all of your travels seem to have been distilled finally into a book that took decades, you know.
Yeah.
For the most recent book.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah, it's always been that way. If I write something raw, so to speak, it's just the language isn't good enough. You know, the emotion may be there, but I don't have enough control over the words.
So what were the other trips then, as long as we're doing the travel?
Back and forth cross country great deal, which I loved. I just loved that. And down to Mexico, and
where did Treblante happen?
Treblante, I took that title from Fuentes, Carlos Fuentes. He had a line in one of his novels, Treblante, and that it's a Mexican slang word apparently. And he said, "Lord, I forget what language I'm speaking," and I was just so influenced by poets, from non-English speaking poets. And like Palenque. There's something about Palenque in there. And there's something just generally about, there's something about an iguana in there.
Did it have to do with the Mexico trip?
Yeah. That was in Treblante. Yeah. And then the African poems started to come out in the temple. Yeah.
And what about Lost Ceilings? What was happening in there?
Lost Ceilings, that's my homage to New York. And I love the prose poem. And
what are you calling? Well, you're looking at the book. You're pulling out something. Why don't you read it for us?
You want me to read it? Okay.
Sure.
I'll read. This is the title poem. And this is about a certain period in my life in New York when I was living alone on Van Damme. First on St. Mark's and then on Van Damme. I had a certain lifestyle. I would either work in a bookstore, or for years I worked in Cinemabilia, the film bookstore on 13th Street. That's when I was on Van Damme Street. And I would work all day, you know, surrounded by film books and memorabilia, and come home and write. And I was up by myself then, and that would, you know, I could do that, just come home and write. I didn't have any other responsibilities. So this is Lost Ceilings. It's about writing, really. Okay. Mirror, mirror on the floor. How the sharp silver slivers reflect the truest likeness of the soul. Splintered insignificant pieces on the edge of this world, a little haunted tonight. The four white walls of the hermitage surround a polar diorama, a landscape of ice interrupted by a pocket of desk lamp light. In the hand of an anchorite, a lantern, Fra Angelico's Annunciation, the horse nebula composed of gas and dust, the pyramids of Giza, picture postcards circumscribed by amber glow, picture postcards left behind at the entrance to an uncharted network of inland seas, soaring wings over choppy water, away from this world. The genie of the alphabet rises out of the typewriter with his rosary of fire, 26 beads of blood for 26 letters to fly in the face of finitude. Half obscured, the telephone receiver lies on its side under a Mexican shawl, muffling its sound. Such solitude as afflicts the room, tilted on an angle unassailed on the cusp of darkness. The bookshelves and tall thin clouds are a heavenly trove of torches, burning pages, paths and spirals, labyrinths, leading the way to a desert birthplace, far, far away from this world, in the midst of an ocean of sand. The genie of the alphabet rises out of the typewriter with his horn of plenty, serenading the lost ceiling of stars.
What a trip.
That's how it felt when writing was really going well, you know? I mean, when it's really going well, it's just, it can be sublime.
You know, it's hallucinogenic. We get you sitting there at the typewriter. The genie of
the alphabet.
The alphabet.
Yeah.
26 beads.
26 letters to fly in the face of finitude.
And yeah. And 26 beads.
Yeah.
Comes for 26 beads.
A rosary. With this rosary of fire. 26 beads of blood for 26.
Blood, that was it. 26
yeah.
beads
yeah, yeah, yeah.
of blood.
Yeah. So it's about the holiness of the alphabet and the blood and sweat of writing, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, you go to Africa and you go to Mexico sitting at that typewriter with the postcards of the past.
Yes, those were all my postcards.
It's all real.
Yeah.
And yet it's totally psychedelic, hallucinogenic.
Well, I think that's intentional. I want to be able to take people away. I mean, I consider myself an escape artist. I'm not particularly comfortable in the real world. I don't think I ever have been. And I want my art to take people away. Take them away from the mundane day-to-day. And get a touch of another world, a beyond, you know, whatever it may be to you. You know, I do believe there is something beyond this realm. Whatever, I don't know what it is. I've spent my life trying to think about it. You know, that's still the great existential question. What is there when you don't believe in conventional religion? You know, so but there is definitely something. I definitely believe in spirit. And I try to, with my words, put people in touch with that somehow. Yeah.
Hence, lost ceilings.
Yeah.
The roof is blown off.
Yeah, and I want it to be. I used to write a lot on drugs. Am I allowed to say that? Nothing more than grass, or hash. But I wanted the poems to have that same druggy feeling, so that they made you feel stoned. And taken away, just like a drug makes you feel that you're escaping the you know.
And some of these poems ended up being recorded with your band, which was called
Lost Ceilings, originally Moving Star.
Moving Star.
They chose that name after a poem of mine, Moving Star. But
how did it happen that you hooked up with Moving Star?
Oh, again, dear Miss Smith gets involved in this too. Hi, chaps. Patty had been married and living in Detroit for a while, and she really wanted to reignite her career. So she managed to get a gig at Summer Stage in New York. She actually asked me to open for her. So, you know, to me, you know, with this love of, you know, being an oratory poet, I was in heaven, you know. I'd also seen, a friend had taken me to see Andrei Voznesensky one night, who Ginsberg had brought to New York. And it was at a church in Gramercy Park. And he's expounding like crazy. He's got everything memorized. I said, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do. So, I opened for Patty. There were like 3,000 people at this reading, at least 3,000. And I get up to the mic, and all the poems are memorized. And I couldn't have been happier. You know, I mean, you know what it's like to read to an audience that big, it just feeds you, right? You just float on it, it energizes, it's just amazing, because we're used to reading in little rooms, to handfuls of people, where that kind of projection seems so inappropriate, you know? But here I was able to do that, and I loved it. Anyway, in the audience that night were two of the fellows from the band, and by then I had moved upstate, and they were real Patty fans. And one fellow, Bob Torcello, I was working at the time with a little library in the town of Goshen. And at the time, we had a little bookstore in the town. And he went into the bookstore and he said, "Do you have anything by Janet Hamill?" And he had no idea, you know. And the woman who ran the bookstore, her name was Jill, and she had a separate section of local authors, you know. And she said, "Oh, Janet, yeah, she works just right down the block at the library. Her book's right over there." So he came into the library and introduced himself and everything. And he was very persistent. I still had no, at the time, I had started writing fiction. Most of the tales in Tales from the Eternal Cafe I had started back then. This was in the 90s. And I had no interest in playing with the band. And he kept, you know, he was very persistent.
So he came to the library. Let's get back there. I want to know what happened. What did you think when he came to the guy shows up at the library? Is that right?
Yeah. I thought, oh, well, that's nice, you know. And he thought he wanted to buy my book, and he was really impressed by my reading. And of course, I was flattered, you know. And he really wanted to be friends. And he also, wanted me to perform. He had a band. And he wanted me to perform with the band, but I was very reluctant. But he brought me one time. He would bring me different things to listen to, you know, to try to persuade me. And he brought me John Trudell, whom I fell in love with. Just one of the greats. Yeah. May he rest in peace.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, I just got chills.
Well, he was almost, except he was so funky. I would say transport, maybe, but except he was so funky, you know. I mean, a shaman who lives in his pickup truck,
yeah.
Trudell, you know.
Oh, what a great voice.
Great voice.
And great musicians.
Writer. And, you know, he truly writes about other realities.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
As well.
Oh, I'm getting very.
Though he's also really political.
Yes.
In his
extremely.
Work,
you know. Right. Goes back to the wounded knee.
Yeah, well, and he, a founder of the American Indian Movement,
yeah.
When he was in jail at Alcatraz.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
So that really moved me.
Yeah.
And then the other record that was really the clincher was Kick's Joy Darkness, a line from Kerouac.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you may have, I don't know if we have the CD.
Yeah.
But it's all different people. A lot of them. Rock and roll people reading Kerouac.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, God, I could do that, you know, because the music, no matter who the musician was, like Patty has a piece on there, I think Michael Stipe does something, John Cale does something, I think Nick Cave does something, all kinds of people do things, and none of it overpowered the words. That was my main concern, that the music not overpower the words. So that kind of did it for me. And I said, okay, I'll try it. I remember driving to my first rehearsal. And we stopped at Jay's house, and he lived quite a bit and further west and north, and more in a rural area than I was, even though I was upstate. And I'm driving up there thinking, I felt really nervous. I'm thinking, what are you getting into? What are you doing? And it just seemed to work. And we did it for quite a while. But it got to the point where if it was going to go any further, if the project was really going to go beyond what it was and become really, really successful, I was going to have to sing, and I was going to have to start writing in rhyme. And I didn't want to do either.
Mm.
And I remember you, when you had Mouth Almighty, when you first signed me to record for Mouth Almighty, you didn't want the band. you wanted me to work with ambient music.
Yeah.
And it took me a long, long time to come around to, that was my conclusion. So now my ideal would be to somehow live work with somebody who can do ambient. Because I like having another person on the stage with me. I know people work with, you know, boxes, they put a box up there on the stage next to them. Seems to work for them, but I'd rather have a person, you know. It relaxes me, it takes away from, the onus isn't just on me, you know. They get tired of looking at me, they can look at the musician or musicians, you know. And it relaxes me.
So with the band that, Moving Star first.
Yeah, we had a hiatus for a while.
And then you put out an album with Moving Star, one or two?
Two, yes. The first one was Moving Star, self-titled Moving Star. You were executive director. Lenny Kay was the producer. You were executive producer. And we recorded that. Lenny wanted to do analog. So we did it up in this little shack. It wasn't more than a shack. Out behind somebody's little log cabin. Up on the top of the Minnewaska Preserve outside of New Paltz. And it took us a long time to do it because we were dependent on Lenny's schedule. So whenever he had a few days, unfortunately he was separated from his wife at the time, so he had free time when he was home, and he would come up and we'd record. And then the second one is Genie of the Alphabet, and that one we produced ourselves. Yeah. And Lenny played on it, though, and Patty played on it, and David Amran. And you sang.
That's right.
We sang.
Yes, we did a duet.
We sang. I came here and we sang. I came to Duane Street.
Yeah.
And you were heading the next day, you and Elizabeth were heading to Denver. You were going out for Naropa. Mm-hmm. And you had your plane was at 7, and I didn't know how you could possibly do both, record that piece and still get some sleep and get on a plane. But you can do things like that.
Was that Flying Nowhere?
That was the poem for 9/11. It was just, what is it called?
Comes Back. That's published in Body of Water, which comes out of Bowery Books.
Yes, yes.
Wonderful, wonderful book that has photos by Patti Smith in it.
Yes, that's right. What else did, I should just look at the index. That would be a good idea. It had a very simple title.
Fellini is in there.
Fellini's in
there. Kerouac is in there.
Mm-hmm.
Such a great piece.
Oh, Byron's timesheet. Sacrifice. I thought for sure it was in here.
Well, to be continued.
Requiem.
It is here, huh? What page is it?
41.
So let's read it.
Okay. Actually, you know Ron Colm.
Sure.
Ron was putting together an anthology of poems about 9/11. He asked me if I had one. I said I have one, but it's sad. It's not political, and I don't know if you'll care for it. He said, no, that's perfect. Everything else everyone's sending me is political poems. I don't want a political poem. So it's you know, should I read it for you?
Well, I'm going to read it with you.
Oh,
we're
going
to. I want to replicate what we did in the studio that day.
Oh, wow.
You ready?
You have such a beautiful voice. Okay.
Oh, sorry.
And we recreated things.
That's right. So that was the deal. You'll start, and then sometimes we trade back and
forth. Maybe you'll just read the, let me see. Well, let's just take it from the top. I'll read the long lines for sure, and then maybe we can read the short lines together.
I'm going to follow you.
Okay.
That's what we did.
You can do that. Yeah,
yeah,
you can
just
improvise.
Follow you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. The precious skyline of glass and steel remains.
Precious skyline remains.
of all that's left.
All that's lost and flowing.
Flowing into the sea.
Flowing.
At the end of the island, where the rivers meet.
Where the rivers meet.
The candles burn for so many.
The candles burn for so many.
Doves crowd the branches.
For so many doves.
Of the blue gardens tonight.
Blue gardens tonight.
In every park, on every corner. A fine curtain of dust settles on the altars of the open city. Photographs and the sweet, heavy fragrance
Photographs,
of flowers.
Sweet, heavy fragrance.
The candles burn for so many.
Burn for so many.
Doves crowd the branches
of the blue garden
tonight. So many wings
so
rising.
So many wings rising.
So many lives ended.
So many lives ended.
In the collapse of the towers.
A common prayer.
Scribbled on scraps of paper.
Scraps.
Blows. City streets.
Streets.
The candles burn for so many.
Burn for so many.
Doves crowd the branches.
Many doves crowd the branches.
Tonight. Beneath the bridges.
Beneath the bridges.
The rivers flow.
The rivers flow.
Sorrow into the sea. Of all that's passing.
That's passing.
Innocence and ashes.
And ashes.
The precious skyline.
The precious skyline.
Glass and steel.
Steel remains. So where did the band... The band traveled, as I recall. Went to Europe.
We didn't go to Europe. We went... to Seattle.
Didn't go to Ireland?
No, they didn't come with me to Ireland.
Oh.
There wasn't money for that. No.
So I went to Seattle.
Seattle. We did the Andy Warhol Museum. We did this place called the Bowery Poetry Club. I don't know, you know them?
Is that where Patty was playing clarinet with you guys?
Yeah.
That was quite a gig.
She played clarinet on both CDs.
Yeah.
Because she has such pride in her clarinet playing. And it takes a certain acquired taste, I think.
No, I think she's wonderful. She meshed perfectly with the wildness of that, the classic garage band.
Yes, I know.
Of the Lost Seals.
I know, you always call them that. Yeah. Classic. Yeah, that was a great night. That was a really great night. That was for the first, I forget whether that was the first or second CD, but we had a great party. We had a really great party. And Patty and Lenny played. Yeah. Wonderful.
You know, I was so thrilled when Knock came out, your most recent book, because in a way it seemed to encapsulate all of your travels, all, you know, your poetries, you know, you put it all into a classic poetic form, but seemed to rebirth it in a way that was completely your own. It seemed like a Knock form to me.
The Knock form.
The Knock form.
Maybe they'll call it that.
You know.
Yeah. I had never wanted to write in form, and never wanted to do rhyme. I was just always, aside from interior rhyme and little alliteration here and there. But when I went back for my MFA, and with the idea of teaching, and I really had to brush up if I was going to teach. English poetry, I had to brush up on my form, because I hated it as an undergrad. I pretty much slept through it. I think I was lucky to get a C in Survey 1, you know. And so I took form one semester, and that's when I was introduced to the pantoum. And I just loved the looseness of it. I loved the repetition of it, and the fact that it didn't have to rhyme. And the fact that it was from... I'm sure the fact that it's from Indonesia has something to do with it, and the fact that I'm drawn to it. It has this, to me, the reason why it originated there and was eventually imported to Europe is because, it's an island nation. I just, you know, surrounded by water, and so you get this feeling of the repetition of the waves coming in, flowing out, coming in again, flowing out, you know.
And then lapping.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And yeah. And then
the sea goes out, and then it's left in the sand.
Yeah.
And the imprint is what you translate
into
the pentum.
Oh, yeah. And then because of the way the repetition works, it just produces really unusual juxtapositions. So then you get this realism.
It's a totally follow you into the trance, you know.
Yeah. The poem almost writes itself, and I just really, really loved it, you know. Some are strictly about my travels. Some are about poets that I discovered and fell in love with. Like, there are a couple of the Mexican poems that are about Mexican poets, and one is about this poet Javier Villarrutia, whom I discovered just a few years ago. He wrote in the 20s and the 30s, mainly the 30s, I guess. The 30s, 30s and 40s, very much an aesthete, you know. And he writes about statues all the time. And when I was thinking of him, I was thinking, he must love Cocteau. It just reminded me of Cocteau. His poetry reminded me of Cocteau. Mm-hmm. And then I read later an interview with him at Octavio Paz, who visited him in his studio. And his studio was all decorated, all black velvet drapes and statues to look like, intentionally, like a Cocteau set, you know. And he said, this is the only way I can live in Mexico, is if I have this refuge, you know. Mm. You know, and then there's one about reading Savage Detectives, you know, Bolaño,
who,
and then there's one about
the poets are the savage detectives, that's
yeah,
what he tells us.
I know.
Yeah.
It's so great. And then there's one about that there's a just great moment in Mexico City when Leonora Carrington and Remedios Varga and Varos and, of course, the one I can't remember is the most famous of all, the one married to Diego Rivera.
Frida Kahlo.
They were all in Mexico City at the same time.
Yeah.
And they were all painting and writing, you know. So
they all wind up in your poem, which you get to talk about. Some of them I know you're going to read for us. You better get those ready for us, what you're going to read.
I thought for sure I'd read about going to CBGB's in the old days.
Oh, my goodness, because
right
it's right
across
the
street.
You know, truth to the door. I love the idea of putting these. I mean, the book is such a perfect form in itself. It's all, the book is a pantoum, the way the poems divvy up into their places and into their peoples. And, of course, these doors that you've got to knock on to get through.
Well, I was so fortunate with that. Yeah, Marianne, whom you met at that the concert with Adele and,
mm-hmm.
and Esther.
Yeah.
And she had, they're from Yemen. These are all doors from Yemen. She had been to Yemen when, and you had been to Yemen.
Yes.
When one could still travel there. And I remember you two hitting it off on that and chatting
yeah.
about that.
Yeah.
But they look enough like North African doors where I was. And she very generously let me use them for the book. And the publisher was fine with that. And it worked out really, really well. And I think I explain in the preface that, or the foreword, that the idea for the book came in a dream. A lot of ideas for poems and books and tales come from dreams. And this was a dream in which somebody gave me a 45 RPM in a little paper wrapper, plain brown paper wrapper. And, you know, 45s, I guess they don't have them anymore, but vinyl 45s, there would always be a cutout in the middle of the paper, and you could see the label inside. So the
right.
label was the color of what we associate with sub-Saharan Africa. It was black background with yellow, green, and red, and it was called Knock of Africa. That was the name of the record. But the music was not in any way African. It was contemporary European electronic music. And the only thing I can think of as to why it would have been that kind of music was because I was listening once again to Eno, Brian Eno. I love Brian Eno's music, especially his purely electronic music, like music for airports, things like that. And he's one of the few writers that I can write my own work to while I'm listening to his music. So I've been listening to Eno, and that's all I can think of, you know.
Wow.
So I started that. That was the first series. I wrote the section called Knock of Africa, and then somebody suggested, well, why don't you just extend it? And so that's why it's broken up into all those different sections.
Well, it's an amazing travelogue of a book, and I didn't know that Knock of Africa came off of out of a record, a 45 in a dream,
yeah,
whose label belies the music.
Yeah.
And those were very early 45s that came where you had a generic,
yes,
sleeve.
Yes.
As I recall, the very first 45 I ever bought was The Lion Sleeps Tonight.
Ah.
A Weem Away, A Weem Away.
Yeah.
So, gosh, that would be mid-50s. But in those, you know, so,
yeah,
you know, they just slide the
oh,
vinyl,
yeah,
into a, they were green, the thick paper.
Yeah.
Generic.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
This is before they had artwork.
Well,
my
oldest brother, he introduced rock and roll to all of us. And he, you know, then it was doo-wop, you know, and there was a little record store in a neighboring town, and he would, you know, you could walk to it, and he would just come home with all these little 45s. That's how they looked back then. And, you know, being young, it just makes such an impression.
Yeah.
An impression that can last a lifetime.
Infiltrate your dreams.
Yes.
And result in a
a book.
Book. Yep. And so tell me something I can hold on to.
Okay. I'll read this to you. In memory of what used to be.
Across the streets.
Indeed.
CBGB.
We're looking right out over it here. Okay. Tell me something I can hold on to. Something to fill empty space, a star name, sold as white wine and tasted like piss. Say something over this bad excuse. CBGB spelled cut glass in four letters. Transcendence is a 13-letter word. I used to go to see my friends break guitar strings and rip jeans and t-shirts. Sold as white wine, it tasted like piss. Say something over this bad excuse. Most bands were unaware of REM's sleep. All they knew were Needles and Heineken. I used to go to see my friends, break guitar strings and rip jeans and t-shirts. Paddy's Horses and Television's Marquee Moon were in love with French symbolism. Most fans were unaware of REM's sleep. All they knew were Needles and Heineken. I stayed until I started lobbing bottles at the audience. What was the point? Paddy's Horses and Television's Marquee Moon were in love with French symbolism. Someone caught a tear in my eye and walked me home to Bleecker and Elizabeth. I stayed until they started lobbing bottles at the audience. What was the point? The music was grounded in three chords, a Bowery flooded gutters and graffiti. Someone caught a tear in my eye and walked me home to Bleecker and Elizabeth. Tell me something I can hold on to, something to fill empty space, a star name.
Well, that's...
That was my experience. Sometimes it was wonderful, but sometimes it was just pretty grimy. And sometimes the fans were really bad. And they did start. I remember the Contortions. You know, it was Adele's band.
Yeah.
It was the hot, you know, throw bottles of beer into the audience. I said, this is madness. Why are they doing this, you know? Why do this to this audience that's here to support you, you know? So that's, by then Patty had moved on to other things and I didn't go much anymore. Yeah.
Well, I like to say that the Bowery Poetry Club is across the street from CBGB, but that kind of, you know, with it being gone for 10 years now.
Is it that long, really?
Well, something like that.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. I remember the last time, I haven't been in it since its current incarnation. The last time I was in it, it was no longer the bar, but you could buy CBGB's memorabilia. You know, little onesies, baby onesies, and t-shirts, and all this stuff.
That's what moved to Las Vegas.
Yeah,
Still can go there and buy your t-shirts.
Yeah. I'm sure they sell a lot of t-shirts.
Yeah, well, it's the real thing.
Right. Right.
So, what are you working on now?
Well, I've gone back to fiction. I really love fiction. It seems to suit me as I've gotten older, and I like making up characters and stories. So I'm working on my first novel.
That's what you seem to be leading up to.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what it's about?
Well, it's actually just like Knock is pretty much one of my most autobiographical writings. It's kind of autobiographical. It takes place in New Jersey, where I was born and raised, and it takes place in a boardwalk town down the shore. And it's a girl from North Jersey, such as myself. It's coming of age thing, so it takes place in the late 60s. So there's a lot of that culture, especially the music and the pop culture. And her mother dies, and her father remarries very quickly after her mother dies. So she runs off with a carny, whom she meets at Palisades Park, but whose family is based further down the shore. And they work the boardwalk, that's their life. So she moves in with him, and his grandmother, his family can't stand her because she's from a middle-class family in northern New Jersey, and they're all semi-gypsies. And so, but his grandmother, the guy she runs off with, really likes her. So they move in with grandmother. And the grandmother, and her name is Madame Bogart, and she has a fortune-telling booth on the boardwalk. And she dies. You want to hear all this? This is just the basics. I'll just tell you the initial part. She passes away. She feels this real bond with Claire, who is the protagonist, the heroine, what have you. And feels a real bond with her. And thinks that Claire is clairvoyant.
Oh.
And you know, Claire, this is all new to Claire. She's never heard of the occult, really. And she thinks a lot of hodgepodge, but she likes Madame Bogart. And Madame Bogart dies. And before she dies, you know, she loves Claire so much. She wants Claire and Marco, that's her boyfriend, to get married. So they get married. And then, not too long after they get married, Marco dies.
Oh,
of a mysterious death. A mysterious death indeed. And in his will, it turns out that Madame Bogart had left everything to Claire in the event of something. She had left everything to Marco, but then should something happen to Marco, everything went to Claire, including the fortune-telling booth on the boardwalk. So Claire doesn't know what to do. She's in such a dilemma. She doesn't want to go home. She doesn't want to stay in in Jersey, in the boardwalk. And her next door neighbor, who was a drag queen, and he's really her best friend, and I love him. He's Richard Dombrowski, but his stage name is Stelladoro. And he talks her into it. He said, oh, come on, give it a try. It's good money, you know. Because Claire does have a very vivid dream life, and so does Richard, and they share their dreams, and you know, he thinks she'll be good for it. So that's how it starts out. So she does inherit the boardwalk booth.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sounds like an incredible character.
Solves the crime of Marco's death. And
wow. Is you know, it sounds like there could be some elements of surrealist.
Well, yes. Well, yes. Well, Madame Bogart, I'm giving away so much. I hope I'm not jinxing it.
Well, let's stop talking about it then.
All right. Okay. Because no. There is a big surreal element.
We'll just leave that there.
Okay.
Unless there's a title that you could throw out, you know.
Well, the working title is Madame Bogart.
Madame Bogart it is.
And it's been something I've been working on since
yep.
I've conceived this character.
I've heard this character before.
I conceived of her in the
70s. Yeah.
I remember driving down to go camping in the Florida Keys. And we drove through the night. And it was Neil and I and another couple. And Steve was the husband of the other couple. And I was in the passenger seat and Steve was driving. And we're going through Georgia in the middle of the night, and there's this great big neon illuminated hand, and it was Madame Bogart fortune telling, and I just thought it was the coolest thing, just so cool. What a name for a fortune teller, you know, good old Humphrey and all that. So I started creating this character. She just never seemed. I've written poems about
yep,
her.
Yep, that's right.
But she never really seemed suitable for that medium, you know. And it was not until I really became comfortable with fiction that I really felt that was where she belonged. So.
Well, I can't wait to, you know, for Madame Bogart to be among the living. So
I can't wait either.
Breathe her as you can. Yeah, your breath. The way that it is, your breath is a voice in your poems. And, you know, it's when Ginsberg would talk about the breath in Whitman and Anne Waldman talking about the breath as the line, dividing the line, you know, but your breath is truly a character in your. Well, thank you for dropping by here.
Hey.
I guess Let's Talk can now move into the past tense. We talked.
We did talk.
I talked on and on.
Yes, as we have many times, I always feel quite comfortable doing.
So, you know, until the next time.
Indeed. Maybe with Madame Bogart.
That's a date.
Yeah, okay. That would be something. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, dear listeners, for being with us. Janet Hamill here in the Bowery Airy, where it was eerie and cleary as Claire became voyant with Janet Hamill.
I'm Bob Holman, and thank you for listening to Poetry is Bread. Subscribe to our podcast to get notifications of new episodes. Check us out at BoweryPoetry.com. The podcast is co-produced by Ram Devanini and Flavia Rocha with Retiplex. Artwork by Fabian Ceruleo. This podcast series is funded by National Endowment for the Arts and New York State Council on the Arts, the Governor of New York State, and the New York State Legislature. Thank you all. Thank you all for listening. Poetry, it goes in one ear and stays there.